Exodus chapter 24. We're going to pick up our study, and we're going to look at a different kind of testimony as we look at the testimony of Israel, which was the tabernacle. And chapter 24 basically is the covenant that was given to Moses for the people of Israel and how it got ratified through the sprinkling of blood. In this chapter, the Lord speaks to Moses, verse 1. It says, "Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, who were the sons of Aaron, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship from afar. And Moses alone shall come near the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people go up with him." So Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments, which were the ordinances. And all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words which the Lord has said, we will do." Willing, but we'll find very quickly they were unable. And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord, and he rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain. Remember the mountain in which was set apart, it was partitioned off. No one was to come near that mountain. And Moses was called to go up that mountain, but no one else was called to come near it. Well, he built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars, according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the children of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. And he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people, and they said, "All that the Lord has said, we will do and be obedient." And Moses then took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, in other words, the other half of the blood. So it was a blood covenant. Half was sprinkled on the altar, half was sprinkled on the people. The idea is that both were sharing in this covenant, the responsibilities of Israel, the responsibilities of God. And he took the book, and they said, "All we'll do, we'll be obedient." And Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and the people and said, "Behold, the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you according to these words." So God made a blood covenant with Israel. Now, it's brought up often by people. Why was it necessary that, first of all, an innocent animal would be slain in order for people to come near God? And secondly, another point on that is, why was it possible that the blood of these bulls were able to allow people to come near God after this? Because what you find is Moses then went up, Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and 70 the elders of Israel, they went up to a certain part on the mountain. In other words, now it's not just Moses, but these others are coming nearer. And they saw the God of Israel. And there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, and it was like the very heavens in its clarity. Now, the Bible says that no one can see God and live. No man can see God and live. So I believe they're seeing as close as they can a representation of the very, you know, God that is making this covenant to them. And the idea of the work of sapphire, it says as it were. It does not say sapphire. People who have that concept, you know, when there's picture language in the Old Testament, is to think, well, gee, now let's see, let's draw a picture of that. No. It's symbolic of that, but as it were, it was something that was dazzling, something that was brilliant. And on the nobles of the children of Israel, he did not lay his hand, so they saw God, and they ate and they drank. In other words, the nobles were not necessarily chosen from among these leaders, but the leaders that God had laid upon his spirit, the ones that Moses had picked out, able men who feared God, hating covetousness. Now, in this covenant, it's been asked, why is it possible that the blood could have allowed them to draw near? And the idea here is that it's the same similar situation to the blood representing the blood of Christ. God knows that he is going to send his son to this world. So he gives them, in a sort of way, kind of an IOU through the blood, so to speak. The blood represented what he was going to do for the people later. They believed in God in faith, just like you and I would believe in him. They were children of God in a very real way because they looked toward the future of God's provision, and the blood of the bulls and goats were just a temporary kind of a pattern for that, such in a way that maybe if someone sat down and wrote a piece of paper, and depending on who that person is writing that piece of paper could be a check, and on that piece of paper it could be worth millions. Now, the paper isn't worth millions, but what it represents is worth millions. Same thing with the blood. The blood of bulls and goats could not take away sin, but what it represented looking into the future through the death of Jesus Christ, it did represent for them an open door to come into the presence of God. Now, the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and be there. In other words, remain there, and I will give you tablets of stone and the law and the commandments which I have written that you may teach them. So Moses arose with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up to the mountain of God, and he said to the elders, wait here for us until we come back to you. Indeed, Aaron and Hur are with you, and if any man has a difficulty, let him go to them. And so Moses left these other guys in charge, which turned out later we'll find to be a major disappointment. Aaron majorly fumbles the ball. The people are getting weary of waiting for Moses, and they cry unto Aaron to make them a god. So they all pitch in their gold earrings, and he melts it down. And when he comes back, there's all the children of Israel worshiping this golden calf. And Aaron's whole explanation was, well, you know, the people, you know, they gave me their gold and I threw it in the fire and this thing popped out, you know. Talking about passing the buck. But they fumbled. Moses went on the mountain and a cloud covered the mountain, and the glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And the seventh day he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. And the sight of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the top of the mountain in the eyes of the children of Israel. And Moses went into the midst of the cloud and went up into the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. So they began to get weary of him waiting for him. But what they did see from a distance was God was like a consuming fire. Now this is a very interesting representation of God in the Old Testament. A consuming fire. Now in a way, depending on what material is in the fire, it becomes better or it becomes worse. And it's a good picture for the very presence of God. You see, we look at hell and we realize that is going to be an eternal burning, an eternal place of suffering. And what's going to be that place of suffering is actually the very presence of God, in a way. Because what happens is, God is a consuming fire to those whose hearts have not been yielded to Him. And eternity sets when they make their choice and God calls them. And they've had their opportunity, and if they fail to follow through and believe in Jesus Christ, God will be to them as a consuming fire. They will be burnt up, so to speak. But if God has changed your heart, the very fire that burns wood also purifies gold. And the very God who is a consuming fire to the wicked of this world is a purifying fire. Not to Israel at this time, he was a consuming fire. He was like, we don't want to get near this guy. This is too much for us. They had a lot to learn about what God's purpose was for their life. But you get this picture of God. Now, really what happens is when a person dies, depending on where they're at, they're going to be like wood or they're going to be like gold. They'll either be purified in the presence of God and will shed off all vestiges of flesh, or they will be utterly consumed. And really, an eternal torment according to the Scriptures. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel that they bring me an offering. From everyone who gives it willingly with his heart, you shall take my offering. Now, he is going to now begin the emphasis on the tabernacle. In fact, from chapter 25 here, all the way to the end of this book, with the exception of a couple of chapters, the rest of this book is on this interesting little thing called the tabernacle, which was only, the tabernacle proper was only 45 feet by 15 feet. It was not very big. And the outer court was only the size of maybe a small city lot, 75 feet by 100 feet. And yet there is a very significant place and purpose for this tabernacle. Now I know a picture is worth a thousand words when it comes to this particular thing, because you have the whole description of it, and then repeated in how it was constructed later on. So you get a lot of repetition in this. So some of these parts we're going to move through very fast. But try to get a picture in your mind. Now, I don't have an overhead projector right now, but I'm going to try the next time we get together, which will be actually sometime in January. I'm going to put a little overhead transparencies up so you can get some pictures in the wilderness of just the different things. Maybe we'll have some pictures of the area of Sinai so you can kind of get the whole idea of what was being presented. But beyond the picture, there is symbolic reasoning for each of these things. You see, there's no less than 50 chapters in the Old Testament and New Testament devoted to the construction, ritual, and priesthood of this tabernacle. That's a lot of emphasis. There's a lot of purpose here. 13 in Exodus, 18 in Leviticus, 13 in Numbers, 2 in Deuteronomy, 4 in Hebrews. 50 compared with 2 on creation. So you see the importance here God stresses on this particular thing. Unfortunately, it's one of those chapters that we kind of neglect. We start reading through about, you know, ram skins dyed red and badger skins and, you know, this covering and so many cubits, and that's about all we can take, and we kind of move on. But there is something very, very interesting here. The first five books of Moses, in fact, trace the story of God's visits to men, and it culminates in this particular thing, God camping with men in a tabernacle, because that's in essence what's happening. God has created this structure in which he can, through its pattern and its ritual and its construction, dwell with them. But it has to be just so. And there's a reason for that that we'll look at. It's interesting when you compare that, the first five books of the New Testament also open up with the subject of God camping with men. You know, when you consider God coming down in Christ, God was manifest, or really as the Bible describes, Christ came as God in the flesh. He manifested God to us. He was the tabernacle, in a way, as the Bible says, God tabernacled among us through the person of Jesus. So the first five books of Moses, culminating with this tabernacle in how God camped with men, are also pictured in the first five books of the New Testament, where God also camped with men through the person of Jesus. So there's a very important thing here. And the whole purpose of the tabernacle was that the presence of God would be in the very center of the camp of Israel. A good place for God to always be is in the very center of your life. When he is not top priority, you're missing something somewhere. There's something wrong in your life. You're off kilter in that relationship. And that will affect every other relationship. That will affect every other decision. It will all be affected by that if God is not in the center. And it was also the tabernacle, the appointed means by which sinful man could approach God. And remember, as you read through this, you'll be sensitive to one thing. Everything had to be made just so. When Moses was on the mountaintop, God gave him not just the Ten Commandments that we're very familiar with as he came down the mountain with the two tablets of stone. He also had in his other arm a set of engineering, instructions for the construction of this tabernacle. So be sensitive to that and be sensitive to the detail. So the Lord first says to Moses, "Speak to the children of Israel that they bring me an offering. From everyone who gives it willingly with his heart, you shall take my offering. And this is the offering which you shall take from them: gold, silver, bronze, blue and purple, scarlet yarn, fine linen thread, goat's hairs, hair, ram skins dyed red, badger skins, acacia wood, oil for the light and spices for the anointing oil and the sweet incense, onyx stones and stones to be set on the ephod and the breastplate." So he is requesting these things for the construction of the tabernacle and the various implements for worship. And it's interesting that the request was for a willing giving. They were to receive a willing offering. Materials used were not compelled by the people, but rather was given as willingness. And later in this book, you'll find that they actually take that offering. And when they do, the people's hearts are so moved to give that Moses has to tell him, wait, we've got enough stuff. Stop giving. We can't handle anymore. And would to God that happened today, in the kingdom of God, that people had a heart to give willingly and hilariously. And that's how I think it's a good pattern here. But God never wants a begrudging gift. He never wants someone to give grudgingly. Because, first of all, you don't get a reward for it anyway. Oh, okay, all right, I'll give. I'm supposed to give. I have to give. Well, God's not interested in that type of a gift. He only wants to build his kingdom willingly. That's why I have a real difficult time with soliciting funds from the world, trying to get out there and fundraise and build the program and get the thermometer up on the wall, and pressure people. Okay, now we've got a building fund and we've got to drive for this and drive for the missionary fund. And no, we try to use the resources God gives us here through the willing giving of the people. We take an offering once, during the Sunday morning services, and that's it. And that's all we want to. And people can give willingly, but they won't hear anything else about it throughout the rest of the week. Because that way, if people who are going to willingly give will give then. And if not, then fine. But I have a difficult time with lots of offerings and drives and all this sort of thing, because eventually people feel put upon and pressured, and then they have to give out of a grudging heart. That is not how the Lord wants the gifts to be. The willingness is revealed in an interesting story of an old farmer visited by a local pastor. The pastor comes up to the farmer and says, "Hey, Jim, listen. He says, if you had two cows, would you give one to the Lord?" The farmer said, "Sure, Pastor, you know I'd do that." And the pastor says, "Listen, if you had two horses, would you give one to the Lord?" And the farmer says, "Yeah, I reckon I would. I'd give one of my horses to the Lord." The pastor says, "Well, if you had two pigs, would you give one to the Lord?" And the farmer says, "No, Pastor, you know that ain't fair. You know I got two pigs." Willingness. "Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them, according to all that I show you, that is the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all its furnishings. Just so you shall make it." Just so. Very detailed instructions. Now, in the beginning of his description, he begins with the Ark of the Covenant. Interesting to note that when God gives the instructions for the building of these things and the order in which he wants them to be built, the order begins with the Ark of the Covenant, which is in the very center of the tabernacle where God will dwell. And then it goes to the implements of the things in the holy place, and it goes out to the altar and eventually the outer court. When men use the tabernacle, it's in the reverse order. So God starts from his presence and then goes out. But when men approach God, they start from the outer court, and they first have to start there, and after many sacrifices, then the priest can go into the holy place, and they take care of the altar of showbread and the altar of incense, table of showbread, and the candlestick and the oil. And then once a year, the high priest would go into the very center where the Ark of the Covenant was and sprinkle blood on the mercy seat to atone for the sins of the people. So there's kind of an interesting thing there. In the building, God begins with the Ark. In the use, man begins with the altar and then concludes with the Ark. So how we approach God always begins with the altar. But God begins them thinking in terms of the very presence of God. So here's the description of the Ark of the Covenant. Now, we are going to be looking at these specifically again. So I'm going to run through them now just to read them, make a few comments. There is a lot of significance in all of them. But I want to run through and lay a foundation, get your minds thinking about it. So the next time we come together and we have some various slides, we can picture them. And we can also give you more of the use and the significance of them. "They shall make an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits shall be its length, and 1.5 cubits its width, and 1.5 cubits its height." So really you have this ark that's only a cubit is about 18 inches generally. Generally felt to be about 18 inches. So you have this this thing where 2.5 cubits would have been... Somebody help me, not quite 4 feet, about 4 feet by 2 feet. So just a very small, really little small box. And but it's made of acacia wood, and it's overlaid, it, verse 11, "with pure gold. Inside and out you shall overlay it, and shall make on it a molding of gold all around. You shall cast 4 rings of gold for it, and put them in its 4 corners. 2 rings shall be on one side and 2 rings on the other side, and you shall make poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. And you shall put the poles and the rings on the sides of the ark, that the ark may be carried by them. The poles shall be in the rings of the ark, they shall not be taken from it. And you shall put into the ark the testimony which I give you," which was the Ten Commandments. And later they were called to put in the Aaron's rod that budded, and also the jar of manna. So there were 3 things eventually that were put in this little ark. "You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold." Now this is what went on top of this little box. 2.5 cubits shall be its length, and 1.5 cubits its width." So it's something that sat right on the top. "You shall make 2 cherubim of gold, of hammered work. You shall make them at the ends of the mercy seat. Make one cherub at one end and the other cherub at the other end, and you shall make the cherubim at the one ends, two ends of it, one piece with the mercy seat. So it was supposed to be constructed of all of one piece of gold. What a cherub looks like, we don't know. In fact, even today, as they look at these instructions for various things, there's a temple institute now in Israel, not the Ark of the Covenant, but other implements of the worship. They're constructing now from these specifications. Given these specifications, however, there's lots of artistic license, because what it doesn't say, they go ahead and add whatever they want to it, as long as it confines itself to these instructions. So what they look like, we don't know how it looked. There's numbers of pictures. But the wings are stretching out above the mercy seat. With their wings, they face one another, and the faces of the cherubim shall be toward the mercy seat. And you shall put the mercy seat on the top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony that I will give you. And there I'll meet with you, and I will speak with you from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim, which are on the ark of the testimony, of all things which I give you in commandment to the children of Israel. So God is going to meet with them in this ark. This is the place where he is going to center his presence. Now, just because there is an interesting comparison here to Jesus, remember, be sensitive when you're reading the Old Testament. Jesus is on about every page. And this is certainly true in this area. Because what you have with the Ark of the Covenant, even the whole tabernacle, it's a representation of heaven. Hebrews 9, Hebrews 8, you have a number of pictures in Revelation which bring out this picture of heaven that the tabernacle represents. Hebrews 8:5 says the tabernacle was a shadow of a heavenly thing. Hebrews 9:24 says it was a pattern of things in the heaven, a shadow of the good things to come in 10:1. So there is this picture. Now with the Ark of the Covenant especially, there's an interesting comparison. Acacia wood is a wood that grows in the desert. It grows in a very, very dry area. I might remind you that Jesus came out of very dry ground. It was described of him. He was put in a very dry, spiritually dry area and planted. Acacia wood grows from the earth, so there is a picture of wood representing Jesus' humanity, but it's a special kind of wood because it's a wood that does not perish. It doesn't rot. It's a very strong wood. In fact, some of the records of it, that if you cut into the wood, what it bleeds, the sap that it bleeds, is actually used for medicinal purposes. And so there's an interesting type there of the wood representing the humanity of Jesus. Is out of his wounds came forth life and salvation for us. But the covering of it complete with gold, there is the dual nature of Jesus, the humanity and the deity. Wood totally overlaid with gold, a picture of the person of Jesus Christ, and the fact that that is where God would meet with them is the perfect type of Jesus, because that is where God met with men through Jesus. You shall also make a table of acacia wood. 2 cubits shall be its length, a cubit its width, a cubit and a half its height. And you shall overlay it with pure gold. You shall make a molding of gold all around it. And you shall make for it a frame of handbreadth all around. You shall make a gold molding for the frame all around. And you shall make for it 4 rings of gold, and put the rings on the 4 corners that are at its 4 legs. The rings shall be close to the frame as holders for the poles to bear the table. And you shall make the poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold, that the table may be carried with them. And you shall make its dishes, its pans, its pitchers, and its bowls for pouring. You shall make them of pure gold. And you shall set the table or the showbread on the table before me always. Now, where this was set, and basically we'll show you a picture, but picture the holy place and the holiest of holies as, you know, one unit. It was a curtain separating the two. The Ark of the Covenant went into the holiest of holies, and that was the only piece of furniture in that place. Then there was this veil, 6 inches thick. It's described in how it was constructed later. We'll look at it. And then you had the holy place where the priest would come in and do the service. If you walked into the tabernacle, you'd see to your right hand, or, you know, into the holy place, you'd see on your right hand the table of showbread. On your left would be this next thing we'll look at, the golden lampstand. And in front of the curtain, which is not listed here in these instructions, but later, would be a small altar with incense burning on it before the throne. There's kind of a real picture of the Trinity right there. You have, the golden lampstand, the Spirit of the Lord, the present in the light of the world. In that sense, you have a picture of Jesus there too. But you also have the showbread, which bread was put on, and Jesus is the bread of life. Then the mercy seat and the Ark of the Covenant represent the presence of God. The altar before that going up as incense. So you have a picture of the Trinity here. Again, this is representing things in heaven. You shall also make a lampstand of pure gold. The lampstand shall be of hammered work, its shaft, its branches, its bowls, its ornamental knobs and flowers shall be of one piece, and six branches shall come out of its side, three branches out of the lampstand of one side and three branches out of the lampstand of the other side. Three bowls shall be made like almond blossoms, and one branch with an ornamental knob and a flower, and three bowls made like almond blossoms on the other branch with an ornamental knob and a flower, and so for the six branches that come out of the lampstand. In the Temple Institute, they have a lampstand made to the specification, and it's sitting there as a representation. It's not made out of gold. It's made out of wood. They'll say, we'll make one out of gold when we get enough donations, but this would be quite a lot of money to make something this big out of pure gold, and it has to be all made of one piece of gold. It can't be like pieces of gold added on. It's all one piece beaten out. So there's a picture there. Now later, people often wonder, you know, why we have a menorah up here, a seven-branched candlestick. And really, it goes back to that our Jewish roots in that respect, but there's also a picture of it in Revelation, where Jesus is, you know, the center, and he's walking, you know, amidst the churches, and the churches are the seven-branch candlestick in a way, where God is in the very present place of the churches. He is there present with them. And he is the center, and, you know, all the light that comes through him. So there is a picture there in Revelation, which is kind of fun to look at in Revelation chapter 1. Now, they'll make this lampstand and the four bowls, and there'll be a knob under the first branches. In verse 36, their knobs and their branches made of one piece. Make seven lamps for it. In verse 37, and arrange its lamps so that they give light in front of it. And its wick trimmers and their trays shall be of pure gold, and it shall be made of a talent of pure gold with all these utensils. A talent was generally believed to be the amount of weight that a person could deadlift. So you could guess anywhere from 150 pounds to 250 pounds, depending on the size of the person, and depending on, you know, there's a lot of possibility there. So that's a lot of gold. That would add up quite a bit. See to it that you make from them according to the pattern which was shown you on the mountain. In fact, you might see a price there in your Bibles, in the margin there. Problem with that price is it's usually the price in which gold was at the time this was this translation was made, and that varies. You know, that goes up and down. Moreover, you shall make the tabernacle with 10 curtains woven of fine linen thread, blue and purple and scarlet yarn, and with artistic designs of cherubim you shall weave them. And the length of each curtain shall be 28 cubits, the width of each curtain 4 cubits, and every one of the curtains shall have the same measurements. 5 curtains shall be coupled to one another, and the other 5 curtains shall be coupled to one another. And you shall make loops of blue yarn on the edge of the curtain and on the selvage of one set. And likewise you shall do on the outer edge of the other curtain of the second set. 50 loops you shall make in the one curtain. 50 loops you shall make on the edge of the curtain that is in the end of the second set. And I know I've already lost you. That's okay. I've lost myself. If you can't picture this in your mind, you're wondering, how is this all fitting together? But you'd have to sit down and you'd have to kind of diagram this out and measure this and plan it and to kind of really get the whole picture here. But you get the idea that they're putting these curtains together. They're making the curtains a specific length and a specific width. Then they're sewing them together with just the right thread. And all these different pieces of blue, and there's all meaning behind all of this. And if I can get you some pictures, we're going to probably go over a little bit more of this meaning. You shall also make curtains, verse 7, of goat's hair to be a tent over the tabernacle. You shall make 11 curtains. The length of each curtain shall be 30 cubits. Now, they make these fine linen curtains, but then everything is covered up on the outside with kind of goat's hair. Not necessarily attractive, but there is a purpose for that. The length of each Where are we here? The length of each curtain shall be 30 cubits, the width of each curtain 4 cubits, and the 11 curtains shall all have the same measurement, and you shall couple 5 curtains by themselves, 6 curtains by themselves, and you shall double over the 6th curtain at the forefront of the tent. Again, you know, it's hard to picture this in our mind, and forgive me for not having a picture readily available for you. But you shall make 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that is outermost in one set, 50 loops on the edge of the curtain of the second set, and you shall make 50 bronze clasps, and the clasps into the loops, and couple the tent together, that it may be one. Now the idea here is that this tent is totally portable. You see, they're making everything so that everything can be rolled up separately and carried, and then when they stop, they can unroll everything, put everything together, clasp everything together, and it can all be one unit, but they're making it portable. Verse 12 says, the remnant that remains of the curtain of the tent, in other words, that length that goes a little bit longer than the length of it is, shall hang over the back of the tabernacle. One cubit, or a cubit on one side and a cubit on the other of what remains of the length of the curtains of the tent shall hang over the sides, and on this side, on that side, to cover it. And you shall also make a covering of ram skins dyed red for the tent, and a covering of badger skins above that. So you've got this layered type of a thing, made out of the different materials to cover this tabernacle. Well, why? I mean, why all this stuff for a thing that there is not going to be any worship going on inside this, with the exception of the priest entering into the holy place, on a weekly basis, and the holiest of holies on once a year. But this incredible construction of this tabernacle. Well, again, there is a picture here. There's a pattern of heaven. The Ark of the Covenant, which we've already seen, is the way of communion. The table of showbread, the way of satisfaction, is pictures of our salvation in this tabernacle. The golden lampstand, the way of illumination. Jesus said, I am the light of the world. The curtains of linen, the righteousness. The fine linen is the righteousness of the saints that's imputed to us, not our own righteousness. And so you come to these various different types of things. The boards and the sockets now we come to in verse 15, which would have been on the side of the tabernacle. And for the tabernacle you shall make boards of acacia wood standing upright. 10 cubits shall be the length of a board, and a cubit and a half shall be the width. So they were about 2 foot wide and about 10 cubits, which would have been 15 feet long. And 2 tenons shall be in each board, for the binding to one another, or tabs, and you shall make thus for all the boards of the tabernacle. And you shall make the boards for the tabernacle, 20 boards for the south side, and you shall make 40 sockets of silver under the 20 boards, 2 sockets under one board for its 2 tenons, and 2 sockets under another board for its 2 tenons. So they kind of fit together, and the sockets then, it would be like tent stakes in a way. They'd go right into the sand. There was no floor on the tabernacle. They'd go right into the sand all the way around these boards that were constructed. And on the second side, verse 20 of the tabernacle, on the north side, there shall be 20 boards, and there are 40 sockets of silver, 2 sockets under one board, 2 sockets under another board. For the far side of the tabernacle westward, you shall make 6 boards. And you shall also make 2 boards for the 2 back corners of the tabernacle, and they shall be coupled together at the bottom, and they shall be coupled together at the top by one ring. Thus it shall be for all of them. They shall be for the 2 corners. So there shall be 8 boards with their sockets of silver, 16 sockets, 2 sockets under one board, 2 sockets under another board. Whew. And you shall make boards, bars of acacia wood, 5 for the boards on one side of the tabernacle, 5 for the boards on the other side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the boards on the side of the tabernacle for the far side westward. I know it's difficult to picture that in your mind. If you want a quick overview of a general picture, there is a picture in the hallway. As you go out this door and you go around the hallway, on your left you'll see a representation of the tabernacle with the presence of God, the cloud coming down upon it. You get a little bit of a picture. There are different, again, artistic views of this particular tabernacle, because some don't know whether it had a flat roof from this description, or if it had a roof that went up and then down, and then all the different linens and clothes, ram skins, etc., badger skins were laid over the top. So there is some various opinions on this thing. But then you shall make a veil woven of blue and purple and scarlet yarn and fine linen thread, and shall be woven with an artistic design of the cherubim. Now this is the inner veil. and hang it up upon the four pillars of acacia wood overlaid with gold. Their hooks shall be of gold, and upon four sockets of silver. And you shall hang the veil from the clasps, and you shall bring the ark of the testimony in there, and behind the veil. And the veil shall be a divider for you between the holy place and the most holy. And you shall put the mercy seat upon the ark of the testimony in the most holy, and you shall set the table outside the veil, and the lampstand across from the table on the side of the tabernacle toward the south. So the door is facing the east. If you walked in, the lampstand would be on your left, which would have been on the south side, and the table of showbread would have been on your right, on the north side. And you shall make a screen for the door of the tabernacle, woven of blue and purple and scarlet yarn and fine linen thread, made by a weaver. And you shall make for the screen five pillars of acacia wood, and overlay them with gold. Their hooks shall be of gold, and you shall cast five sockets of bronze for them. So there's gold, there's silver, there's bronze. Now when we look at this tabernacle when it's being constructed, and we see the different things that are made, and you know the different purposes of it, realize this: there's a purpose behind the gold. Gold represents deity. So when you see gold, you represent something that was to be set apart as a picture of the Lord. When you see silver being used, there's a reason for that. Silver is the price of redemption. So when you see silver, you see God now connecting himself with man through redemption, the price of redemption. It's interesting that the top rings and that sort of thing, and where the gold boards are connected, is all of gold. But where they connect the earth, where the boards have the pegs on the ends that go into the earth, are made of silver. So there's this picture now, God coming down, silver is a connection. When you see bronze is always a representative of judgment. So there's these three things happening: the very holiness and deity of God. Yet, because of the sin nature of man, bronze, judgment. But in between that, you've got the silver, where you have the silver representing the redemption, the price of redemption. So there is a reason for each of these things, made of different purposes. I want to run through chapter 27, and it'll set us up for the next time when we get together. We'll have some pictures, and we'll see how this all comes together. You shall make an altar of acacia wood, 5 cubits long, and 5 cubits broad. Now this is quite a bit bigger than the tables and the mercy seat. The altar shall be square, and its height shall be 3 cubits. So that's 3 cubits is about 7.5 feet. And this is how tall this altar shall be. You shall make its horns on its four corners. Its horns shall be of one piece with it, and you shall overlay it with bronze. Bronze, particularly, because this particular thing is to be used in the sacrifices. So now where the blood of the sacrifices is being spilled, bronze representing judgment. The sin is being judged. Bronze in the altar. You shall make its pans to receive its ashes, its shovels, and its basins, and its forks, and its fire pans. You shall make all its utensils of bronze. You shall make a grate for it, a network of bronze, and on the network you shall make 4 bronze rings at its 4 corners. And you shall put it under the rim of the altar beneath, and the network may be midway up the altar. And you shall make poles for the altar, poles of acacia wood, and overlay them with bronze. The poles shall be put in the rings, and the poles shall be on the two sides of the altar to bear it. And you shall make it hollows with boards, as it was shown you on the mountain, so they shall make it. So this altar is to be used for the sacrifices. It's a little confusing, because some critics have argued, well, wait a minute, if you've got wood, this altar made of wood with gold overlaying it, and you build a fire on top of it, it's going to melt the gold, and you're going to burn the wood. So that doesn't make sense. The problem is when you realize this whole altar is actually made almost really a frame around that which is believed to be rock. The rock would be the altar, and the frame of this wood and the gold would have been the frame around it with its network and everything that it had. Again, we'll get a picture of that. You shall also make the court of the tabernacle. On the south side there shall be hangings for the court, woven of fine linen thread, 100 cubits long for one side, and its 20 pillars and their 20 sockets shall be of bronze, and the hooks of the pillars and their bands shall be of silver. So you've got these pillars all the way around the tabernacle, so really it's a tent. Between the pillars then the curtains would be hung. Likewise, along the length of the north side there shall be hangings 100 cubits long with its 20 pillars and their 20 sockets. So you've got the north and the south sides at 100 cubits, which would have been 150 feet. And verse 12 also, and along the width of the court on the west side shall be hangings of 50 cubits, so 75 feet on the width, with their 10 pillars and their 10 sockets. So 10 pillars in between 75 feet, so every 7.5 feet there would be another pillar. And the hangings on one side of the gate shall be 15 cubits, verse 14, with their 3 pillars and their 3 sockets. And on the other side shall be hangings of 15 cubits with their 3 pillars and 3 sockets. For the gate of the court shall be a screen 20 cubits long, woven of blue and purple and scarlet yarn and fine linen, made by a weaver. And it shall have 4 pillars and 4 sockets. And all the pillars around the court shall have bands of silver, and their hooks shall be of silver, and their sockets of bronze. The length of the court shall be 100 cubits, and width 50 throughout, and the height of 5 cubits, woven of fine linen thread, and its sockets of bronze. All the utensils of the tabernacle for its service, its pegs, and all the pegs of the court shall be of bronze. Then you shall command the children of Israel that they bring you pure oil of pressed olives for the light, to cause the lamp to burn continually. In other words, in the golden lampstand, the oil was given to burn continually. Bread was to be continually on the table, and it was replaced once a week by the priests. In the tabernacle of meeting outside the veil, which is before the testimony, Aaron and his sons shall send it from evening until morning before the Lord. It shall be a statute forever to their generations on behalf of the children of Israel. This whole picture should illustrate to us, again, Christ as the tabernacle. I want to point out a couple of things for you to be sensitive to. Next time we come together, we'll look a little more closely at this, and we'll see where Christ fits into this. But just for fun, if you compare this tabernacle between, you know, the tabernacle and Jesus, make that comparison. Number one, the tabernacle was a temporary structure. Later, the temple became permanent. Jesus, the first time he came temporarily, only three and a half years of ministry on this world. And then he went back to the Father. He was here for 33 years or so, but actually ministering 3 years. So he was only here temporarily. The tabernacle was a temporary structure. In fact, if you compare the number of years the tabernacle was actually used, because it takes a period of time for them to make it, and they use it up to the time they go into the land, it's actually used for about 33 years. So it's the same age that Jesus is. He's here for 33 years. So you see, the Lord's trying to make that obvious. Second, it was for use in the wilderness, as Jesus came into the wilderness. Thirdly, it had a very humble look to it, very unattractive from the outside. Now you look at all this gold, and you think, wow, all that gold, it's got to be dazzling. But when you see how they constructed it, all the gold from the outside is covered up. You don't see any of it. On the outside, you don't see any of it. Now, you know it's very valuable. Gold is in there. You think if you got that much gold, you're going to display it, right? No, it's all covered up. Jesus was deity, but veiled in humanity. He had a form or comeliness, nothing about him that really moved people to go, oh, what a beautiful man. He was very plain looking. He had no form or comeliness that men should desire him. And so you have that picture of the tabernacle, unattractive Jesus as that picture. The tabernacle was the dwelling place of God. Jesus was the dwelling place of God. In him, all the fullness of deity dwelt. The tabernacle was where God met men. No one can come through God except through Jesus. The tabernacle was the center of camp. Jesus is to be the center. The tabernacle was the place where the law was preserved. The law was kept and preserved. It's a good picture of Jesus because in his life, he never committed one sin. He was perfect. In holy and without sin. And the law of God was preserved. He does always those things that please the Father. Then the eighth point, it was the place where the sacrifice was made. Jesus offered himself up as a sacrifice. And then finally, one thing that's very important about the tabernacle, all around the structure, you realize there's only one door on the east. You have to go in one door. Jesus said, I am the door. You know, he is the only door in which to get into the Father. There's only one door. There's no other entrance into this tabernacle, which represents heaven. And so Jesus becomes a perfect type, or the tabernacle is a perfect type of Jesus and has its fulfillment in the person and the ministry of Jesus. Well, it's hard to picture these things, but, you know, bear with us. We'll get through this section. We will probably pick up the pace only because with pictures, we'll probably just show you some pictures and we'll try to move on a little bit faster so we can see some of the significance of this. And instead of labor over all the different cubits and, you know, sockets and stuff like that.